Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. Now, I'd like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. Tom Skinner. You may begin.
Thank you, Victor, and thank you all for joining us today for the release of a new CDC Vital Signs report. This one on the demographic and substance use trends among heroin users in the United States for the years 2002 to 2013. We're joined today by the director of the CDC, Dr. Tom Frieden, who will provide some opening remarks. We also have Dr. Chris Jones with the Food and Drug Administration, one of the authors of the study, to help with questions if necessary. So right now I'd like to turn the call over to Dr. Frieden.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thank all of you for joining us today to discuss this month's Vital Signs report. The topic is the heroin crisis, and we worked closely with the Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, on this report. Heroin use has increased rapidly across the U.S. and throughout society. The bottom line is this: heroin use is increasing rapidly across nearly all demographic groups, and with that increase, we're seeing a dramatic rise in deaths. Information available suggests that two factors are leading to this big increase. It's really a 1-2 punch. First is an increasing number of people primed for heroin addiction because they're addicted to or exposed to prescription opioid painkillers. And second is an increase in the supply and accessibility and a decrease in the cost of heroin. Those two factors, we believe, are driving this increase and drive the strategy that we need to use to turn it around. I'd like to put this into perspective to start. In just a decade, from 2002 to 2013, the landscape changed. And although we saw an increase in heroin use among nearly all groups, the largest increases were among women, non-Hispanic whites, and others, groups that have historically had lower rates of heroin use. Heroin use doubled among women and more than doubled among non-Hispanic whites. Alarmingly, nearly all people who used heroin also used at least one other drug in the past year, and most used at least three other drugs. The use of multiple substances increases a person's risk of overdose. Most were using alcohol, cocaine, and marijuana in addition to heroin. The relationship between heroin and opioid painkillers was particularly strong. In fact, abuse or dependence on opioid painkillers was the strongest risk factor for heroin abuse or dependence. People who abuse or who are dependent on prescription opioid painkillers were 40 times more likely to have heroin abuse or dependence. Previous research has found that the rate of heroin initiation among people with a history of non-medical use of prescription opioids was 19 times higher than those without a history of non-medical use. As heroin use, abuse, and dependence have increased, so have heroin-related overdose deaths. In fact, we found that the rate of heroin-related overdose deaths nearly quadrupled. In 2013 alone, more than 8,200 people died from heroin overdoses. Most heroin-related overdose deaths that year, 60%, involved at least one other drug. And I want to put this in perspective. There are, by the best estimate, a little over 500,000 people who are addicted to heroin in the U.S. The fact that more than 8,000 of them died in a single year suggests that around 1 in 50 people who are addicted to heroin may die from it in each year of their addiction. That's a remarkably high proportion and a reflection of how dangerous it is to have a heroin addiction, to have heroin supply from sources where the purity may change rapidly, and to be using it by an intravenous route. I'd also like to comment that there is sometimes a perception that as measures to improve prescribing of prescription opiates have been rolled out, there's been a move to heroin among people who had previously been on prescription opiates. And I think that's actually not what's happening. That's not what the data shows. While it's certainly the case that that may be what happens for some individuals, in general, what we're finding is that the higher the rate of prescription opiate use, the higher the rate of heroin use. So what we really think is happening is that 1-2 punch of more people primed for heroin addiction because they're addicted to prescription opiates, which are, after all, essentially the same chemical with the same impact on the brain as heroin. And then second, that increase in supply and access and decrease in the cost of heroin. Heroin costs roughly 5 times less than prescription opiates on the street, although obviously the data on that is hard to come by. The latest analysis of heroin trends add to the real devastation that the opioid epidemic is causing in communities across the country. Most people coming in to treatment for heroin addiction report injecting the drug. And I'll tell you that as a doctor who started my career taking care of patients with HIV and other complications from injection drugs, it's heartbreaking to see injection drug use making a comeback in the U.S. We're seeing clusters of hepatitis C and of HIV coming from opioid injection. The opioid epidemic cuts across the lifespan, and in addition to abuse, overdose, and death, we're seeing rising rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome. That's a series of issues for newborns exposed to drugs in the womb with tragic consequences. We're also seeing drugged driving and opioid-related falls among senior citizens. So fundamentally, the question is, what can be done? And there are things that can make a difference. With heroin impacting communities and families across the nation, everyone can help fight this and become part of the solution. Change at the state level is particularly critical to address the heroin epidemic. The approach has to include both prevention and treatment and recovery for those who abuse or are dependent on heroin. States can make prescription drug monitoring programs timely and easy to use, can look at the data and practices of state Medicaid and workers' compensation programs, and increase access to substance abuse treatment services, including medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. They can ensure that Medicaid and other insurers provide coverage for all forms of MAT and support adoption of MAT in community settings. Also expand access to and training for administering naloxone or Narcan to reduce opioid overdose deaths, and ensure that people have access to integrated prevention services, including sterile injection equipment from a reliable source as allowed by local policy and law. They can also help jurisdictions put these effective practices to work where drug abuse or dependence is common. Healthcare providers can also play an important role by following best practices for responsible prescribing to reduce abuse or dependence, understanding that there's a risk and a benefit to every medication. And for prescription opiates, the risks are very palpable. A few doses and someone can have a life of addiction. A few pills too many and someone can die from overdose. Prescribers can also use drug monitoring programs and ask patients about current or past drug and alcohol use prior to considering opioid treatment. Prescribers can also use non-opiate means of addressing non-cancer pain or chronic pain syndromes, and can link patients who do have problems with effective substance abuse treatment services and ensure that if they are using prescription opiates, they use the lowest effective dose and the minimum quantity needed. In the federal government, we're undertaking a series of measures to address the problem. One is developing prescribing guidelines for chronic pain. These guidelines will help advise healthcare providers and are due out early next year. In the meantime, we're asking providers to be judicious when prescribing these drugs because they are so powerfully addictive. We are also supporting the use of prescription drug monitoring programs, which are electronic databases that track the dispensing of certain drugs as a routine part of clinical practice, increasing access to substance abuse treatment services, expanding the use of medication-assisted treatment, supporting the development and distribution of naloxone, which can reverse overdoses, supporting the research, development, and approval of pain medications that may be less prone to being abused, although would still be addictive, improving surveillance to better track trends, identify communities at risk, and target prevention strategies. It's so important that Secretary Burwell has introduced an opioid initiative that emphasizes not just prescribing, but also access to substance abuse treatment and increased use of naloxone as key levers to reverse this epidemic. In addition, we're working closely with law enforcement, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and local and state law enforcement entities to work together to focus on communities where heroin may be increasing. This is an important partnership so that we can support the efforts of law enforcement to make heroin less accessible to increase effectively the cost of it, as occurs with other addictive substances. If the cost increases, the use decreases. Our goal is to prevent people from starting to use heroin by reducing prescription opioid misuse, reduce heroin addiction by ensuring access to medication-assisted treatment, and reverse heroin overdose by expanding the use of naloxone. The bottom line is that heroin use is increasing among nearly all sectors of society, largely driven by an increase in prescription of and addiction to opioid painkillers, priming people for heroin use and by cheaper, more available supplies of heroin. We need an urgent all-of-society response to improve prescribing, prevent people from becoming addicted, help those who are addicted for treatment, and work with law enforcement at all levels to reduce heroin supply. Everyone has a role to play: states, public health, healthcare providers, families, communities, law enforcement, and to those who may be addicted or become addicted, seek help because treatment works. So I'll stop here and we'll turn it over for questions.
Hey, Victor, I believe we're ready for questions, please.
Okay, sir. We will now begin a question and answer session. To ask any questions over the phone, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone, unmute your phone, and record your name at the prompt. To withdraw your questions, press star 2. One moment, please, for incoming questions. And our first question comes from Mike Stoad with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I had two questions, actually. I think I heard Dr. Frieden use the number 500,000 to talk about the number of abusers of heroin. I was wondering, the survey talks about people had used heroin in the past year. I was wondering, in the 2011-2013 segment, how many people, roughly that rate translates to, how many 100,000 people had said they'd used heroin in the previous year, and how had that number, what had that number been back in the 2002 to 2004 range? And then I have a second question I can tell you now or tell you after that.
Why don't we take the first question? I'll turn that over to Dr. Chris Jones, who is the first author of the report.
Sure. Thanks. So to answer that question, when you look at the first time cohort that we included in the study, 2002 to 2004, there were roughly 379,000 people who reported past year use of heroin. So that's essentially any use of heroin in the 12 months prior to the survey being conducted. Contrast that with 2011-2013, and that number or annual average between those 3 years was 663,000.
Okay,
almost 300,000 more people reported past year use of heroin.
Okay. Thank you. And the other question had to do with white people. The table talks about the increase, 114% increase in white people, and then a negative 15% in other groups. I was wondering why we think this is so concentrated among Caucasians, and when the statistics flipped. I see going back through the years, it looked like 2008, 2010 was really when we saw the biggest jump. What happened in those years, if that was the time when white use eclipsed the use by other racial or ethnic groups?
This is Dr. Frieden. I'll start the response and then turn it over to Dr. Jones to continue. In general, what we're seeing is more of a leveling than a greater increase, that though the rates are a little higher in some groups than the others, what we're seeing is an increase throughout many different sectors of society. Dr. Jones?
Right. So specific to your race ethnicity question, I think, and this is consistent with other data sources that are in the peer-reviewed literature, that we see a demographic shift in the last 10 to 15 years compared to 40 or 50 years ago. where the profile of people who are reporting heroin use, again, as Dr. Friedman said, really not finding declines anywhere, but where we're seeing some of the greater increases, are among the population who seem to mirror the populations who've reported high rates of prescription opioid abuse in the last 15 years or so. So that's where you see non-Hispanic whites, increases among males, among females compared to males, privately insured, higher incomes. And so I think you're starting to see the population of heroin users more closely resemble what we've seen in the past decade or so with prescription opioids. And I think it is, you know, as pointed out from the strong risk factor from this research around prescription opioid abuse and dependence and having significantly higher odds of heroin abuse or dependence and prior research showing that prior non-medical use is a significant risk factor for heroin initiation.
Next question, Victor.
Our next question comes from Lenny Bernstein with The Washington Post. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. Among the 8,200 people who overdosed in 2013, I think Dr. Frieden said 60% involved one other drug. Does that mean you found it in their bloodstreams or they were known to be taking that drug? What does involved mean?
Sure. So this is Chris Jones. So among the deaths, the way the particular drugs involved in death are listed on a death certificate, it's a determination by the official who fills out the death certificate, so the medical examiner or coroner, that the other substances were a contributing cause of death, not that they were simply present. And so the 60% of deaths where other drugs were involved, what that means is that they were determined to be a contributing cause to the death, and the death was an overdose. Or drug poisoning, and heroin was also a contributing cause.
Thank you. And do you know, are prescription opioids the most common among those other drugs?
They're not, actually. Cocaine is the most common co-involved substance among the heroin deaths.
Thank you.
Next question, Victor.
Our next question comes from Claire Hughes of Times Union. Your line is open.
Hello, thanks for taking my question. Dr. Frieden, I was hoping to clarify something that you talked about in terms of when you were speaking about the move to heroin among people who have previously been on prescription opioids. Is what you're saying that they continue to take both the heroin and the opioids together and that it's not a move from one drug to the other?
So I was addressing what is sometimes a perception, because it is the case that there has been some progress in the last few years reducing overdose deaths from prescription opiates. And there's a perception, and for some individuals there may be the reality, that because it got harder to get prescription opiates, they switched to heroin. But the broader trend that we're seeing is that so many people, about 12 million, have used a prescription opiate in the U.S. And those people, many of them, maybe I shouldn't say those people, many of those individuals, perhaps as many as half, may be frequent users of prescription opiates and therefore primed or highly susceptible to addiction. The chemical is essentially the same between the prescription medication and heroin. So when heroin is five times cheaper and much more widely available, it becomes something that's driving this trend of rapid increase in heroin use. I don't know if that was clear.
No, I actually did understand it. I guess I didn't understand what perception it was. I mean, this seems consistent with what we've been writing. I don't exactly understand what perception it was you were trying to overcome. Was it that people think that one drug is leading to another and then it's not an issue of availability, supply, et cetera?
This is Christian. I think it was the idea from a policy perspective,
mm-hmm.
That policies that have been put in place to curb inappropriate prescribing are what's driving the problem. And you see in many states that there were shifts towards heroin long before states were robustly addressing the prescription opioid issue. And I think, as this study points out and other studies have also found similar things, that it's very much a gray. People will initiate heroin use, but they'll go back to prescription opioids or use them in combination depending on what's available. And as we found here, you know, in 2011-2013, 45% of people who reported heroin use in the past year met criteria for abuse or dependence on prescription opioids.
This is Tom Breeden again. Let me put it more clearly. Improving prescribing practices for prescription opiates is part of the solution, not part of the cause of the heroin problem.
Okay. I understand the point you're trying to make now. Thank you very much.
Next question, Victor.
Our next question comes from Robert King with the Washington Examiner. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I wonder if you could touch on the role of abuse deterrent opioids, painkillers. Does that have they been helping to kind of stem any of these this transition or anything, or how have they aided in this issue?
So I think the science on abuse deterrence is still very new, and it's important to point out that. Chris Jones. So it's important to point out that the products that have received labeling from FDA, there are four products that talk about abuse deterrent properties, have been designed to deter primarily intranasal or injection drug use, but can still be abused by those routes and certainly can be abused orally and retain their addictive properties. And I would say that, you know, there are some studies that find some declines in abuse of particular products that have reformulated to an abuse deterrent product or have labeling for abuse deterrence. But I think it's certainly unclear of the longer-term public health impact, and more study needs to be done to really understand the role that abuse deterrence plays in the broader policy scheme of addressing prescription opioid use. But I think generally everyone's goal would be to have pain medications that are effective at improving pain and function that are much less prone to abuse through all routes. I mean, the ultimate goal would be to either have newer classes of pain relievers that are not prone to addiction or to have opioid products that are reformulated in a way that deters abuse by all routes.
I guess I would just want to make very clear that abuse deterrent doesn't mean not addictive. It means that it may be harder to melt it down and shoot it up or abuse in other ways, but they remain highly addictive medications, which, if you take a few doses too many, will suppress your respirations and result in death.
Right, and I'll just add a finer point to that, that there have been no studies to show that any product that has been reformulated has shown any reductions on addiction or any reductions in overdose death as far as any robust studies.
Next question, Victor.
Once again, for any questions over the phone lines, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone and record your name at the prompt. Our next question comes from Stacy Singer with the Palm Beach Post. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I'd like you to flesh out a little bit this idea of alternatives to using these opioid pain medications. And I'm specifically wondering whether you and the FDA, whether the CDC and the FDA have been communicating with each other on this issue. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a time when pain was not treated with this class of drugs at all, and seems like things went better back then. Why are they still on the market? That's one of my questions.
So, CDC and FDA do work closely together. In fact, this is Dr. Frieden. I'm sitting here with Dr. Jones, who's the first author on the article and previously was at CDC. If you go back in time far enough, you've seen a pendulum swing multiple times about use of opioid medications for pain and other conditions. Initially, going back almost 100 years, they were widely used, and then it was widely understood how devastating the addiction was. For then about a generation, they were not used, and even there were the bad old days when people with really excruciating pain from cancer or other conditions were not treated. And then the pendulum swung again, and I can say that when I went to medical school, we got one lecture on pain in which we were told that someone with pain who got an opiate would not get addicted. And that's absolutely false. And we're seeing now the need to really get it right in terms of the risks and the benefits. So if someone has severe terminal pain from cancer, you absolutely want to provide all palliation. If someone has excruciating pain from a surgical procedure or a car crash, you absolutely want to provide pain relief. For chronic non-cancer pain, you really have to look at the risks and the benefits. And the risks are very, very clear. A few pills and you can get addicted, a few pills too many and you can die. The benefits are far less clear because of acclimation to the drug and the way the liver metabolizes these drugs. People need higher and higher doses, which become closer and closer to lethal doses. Now, getting that risk-benefit ratio right is a challenge. I can say that for myself personally and for patients and friends I've cared for, even with severe pain, we look for alternative ways to get treated because we recognize that these are dangerous drugs. Those can include non-steroidal medications, anti-inflammatories of various types, physical therapy, the use of ice or heat or local measures, movement and modification of some of the ways that you can trigger or avoid pain, a realistic sense of how long it will take for a pain syndrome to resolve, encouragement if you see that resolving gradually. There are a whole host of things that can be done to support patients in a way that's both safe and effective. Dr. Jones?
And I'll add, from an FDA perspective, I think we recognize the limitations of opioids in treating all types of pain. And certainly the revisions that we made to our labeling a couple of years ago for the extended-release long-acting opioids was an attempt to really clarify the patient population who are likely to have benefit from receiving opioids. And one particular point of that labeling change is in the limitations of use. We actually specify to providers to reserve these products for use in patients for whom alternative treatment options that includes non-opioid analgesics or immediate-release opioids are ineffective, not tolerated, or would otherwise be inadequate to provide sufficient pain management. At the same time, we recognize for many types of chronic pain, and some of the most common types of chronic pain, so musculoskeletal or neuropathic pain, opioids are not likely the best treatment option. And so we have tried to work with the drug industry to incentivize the development of non-opioid pain medications that can be used for those conditions. And we've actually approved several products in the last 4 or 5 years that have indications for chronic low back pain or other types of musculoskeletal pain that are maybe more beneficial in those patients than receiving opioids.
I'm in South Florida, and just this morning on the radio, I was listening to radio ads over and over again from a dentist who keeps saying, come to me for dental pain, come to me for dental pain, pain, pain. And I'm like, oh, man, dentists are using these too. How do we tackle that?
I think partly, you know, from a regulatory perspective, it's trying to provide the most up-to-date scientific information to help providers make informed decisions about prescribing. But I think fundamentally, if you look across the health professions, there's really inadequate education around pain management and substance abuse. And I think collectively, from an HHS perspective and other agencies, to work with the health professional schools to train new providers to adequately address pain comprehensively, not just writing a prescription for an opioid, but what are the best ways to treat pain for the particular patient you're treating. So I think that's a fundamental area of interest for the department.
In addition, the use of prescription drug monitoring programs can identify providers who may have outlier patterns of prescribing opiates and may need either information and education or enforcement action if they're serving essentially as pill mills.
Victor, we'll take one last question, please, and then we'll have Dr. Frieden conclude our call.
Absolutely, sir. Our next question comes from Kimberly Leonard with U.S. News & World Report. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make sure that I understand this clearly. Is the reason that these prescription drugs are given at such a high rate, does a lot of it have to do with misunderstanding by providers? Dr. Frieden, you mentioned the lecture you received in medical school. Are providers just not aware of the danger that they could be putting patients in with these medications?
I think it can be challenging for providers, and often the path of least resistance is to write a prescription rather than spend the time to address some of the root causes of the patient's pain. And it may be that the individual doctor doesn't see the long-term consequences for that individual of addiction, overdose, death, and the social and medical impact that it can cause. So I wouldn't want to blame physicians. There are real challenges in addressing what patients expect and taking the time in what can be a very busy office encounter to ensure that what we're providing as physicians is not the most treatment, but the best treatment and the most appropriate treatment.
Mm-hmm. So is it clear whether most of these prescriptions come from directly from a doctor or whether there are teens who begin to maybe go into grandmother's medicine cabinet or something like that? Is it clear where they're getting access? Does it seem to come mostly from physicians and from people who shop around for doctors?
This is Chris Jones. I would say the vast majority of prescription opioids that are used for non-medical purposes originate from a prescription.
Okay.
As people are beginning non-medical use, the medicine cabinet is a common option where people are obtaining it or getting it from free for friends and family. A separate study that we did a couple of years ago looked at the source for people based on the frequency of non-medical use. So the really high-risk group are the more chronic non-medical users. They're more likely to have addiction, et cetera. And when you look at that group, their most frequent source for the prescription opioids that they most recently used for a non-medical reason is a provider.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really highlights the fundamental role that providers play in the solution in using things like prescription drug monitoring programs and screening patients for risk prior to prescribing prescription opioids.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dr. Frieden, would you like to conclude our call, please?
I'd just like to reiterate the bottom line here, which is that heroin use and deaths from heroin are both increasing rapidly and increasing among many different demographic groups. But we can turn it around, and we can turn it around by a package of both public health and healthcare and law enforcement activities. From the standpoint of the public health approach, it's to prevent people from starting heroin through better prescribing practices, to reduce heroin addiction by increasing access to medication-assisted treatment, and to reverse heroin overdose through expanded use of naloxone. From the law enforcement standpoint, it's to reduce the availability and increase the price of heroin by disrupting supply networks, and that partnership with the law enforcement is very, very important for that and something that we'll be working on increasingly in the coming months and years. Thank you all very much for your interest and for your coverage.
Thank you all for joining us today. This concludes our call. Reporters wanting to ask follow-up questions or needing additional information, including copies of any of the accompanying materials, can call the CDC press office at 404-639-3286. Thank you.
Thank you all for your participation in today's conference. You may now disconnect.